Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Diversity American Style with Chuck Ashman, only on LA Talk Radio.
There are a great many veteran organizations, and the overwhelming number of them are dedicated, passionate, committed, honest, and really helping those who've been in harm's way with every aspect of civilian life, from providing routine information, legitimate gripes, to dealing with those who have given up. Ask the leadership of veterans who they look to, who they respect, who rests comfortably on an unprecedented 30-year history of service, solutions, and success. And they will say the National Veterans Foundation and its founder and CEO, Shad Meshad. Ask Greg Lee, for example. He's the chairman of California's Commanders Council with the leaders of 19 veteran organizations. And he'll agree. Ask Mark Thurston, who credits Shad Meshad with nothing less than saving his life so that he now helps so many vets with their problems. You can ask me. As a journalist, I had to deal with the groups that, well, let's be generous, are not performing as well as they should. They're making too much money personally and sometimes worse. The National Veterans Foundation is the gold standard. The best and the brightest, certainly the most reputable, clearly the most dedicated of all the vet help associations. If necessary funding was made available solely on the basis of merit, my guest in studio, Bill Morgan, would be out of work. It's not. The nonprofit world, the good guys, and the not-such-good guys compete out of necessity with the same intensity of used cars, computers, or toothpaste. And all too often, funding goes to the best ad and not the best cause. Bill Morgan's Marine Corps Master Sergeant father obviously instilled the value system, the humanity that are the essence of a member of the Corps. That's why when you've been discharged, you never say you're an ex-Marine. There are none. There are Marines. They're not all on active duty, but they are Marines. Bill Morgan has worked with several of the most respected nonprofits like Feed Our Vets and the Junior Blind Foundation, the LA Food Bank, and now he is charged with the awesome responsibility, both in development and in operations, working with Shad and reaching out to help so many who need it. Bill, is it frustrating knowing that despite how worthwhile the cause, what I was talking about, despite the fact that 10,000 vets are reaching out and asking for help, despite the need to go around the clock and not just 9 to 5 when, God forbid, a potential veteran suicide might reach out, you have to go to the marketplace. You have to cajole, explain, compete, maybe beg a little to get basic funds.
Yeah, there's a lot of cajoling and begging that goes on in my daily work, absolutely. You know, fundraising in the veteran space is a sort of a zero-sum game. I mean, all of us, you know, thousands and thousands of veterans organizations are competing for the same fundraising dollars. And there are a lot of organizations out there that have great marketing programs and a lot of marketing money and names that communicate instantly what they do. And when someone is is in a place where they want to support a veterans organization. The National Veterans Foundation is not always the organization that first comes to mind. And it's a challenge for us to get our name out there and to communicate the work that we're doing. And it's a little bit of a struggle sometimes.
Yeah, but you win the struggle. Who calls your hotline? Where are they calling from? And when they call, how much do you know about them?
We know nothing about them other than usually they're a veteran or a veteran family member. We get calls from across the country. We serve veterans of all eras. So we get calls from Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, Vietnam veterans, veterans of the Korean War, World War II veterans and their family members sometimes. And, you know, we're a one-stop hotline for all of these veterans with any issue they're having. So they could be having issues with, accessing benefits. They could be suicidal. They could be looking for help with PTSD counseling. Anything that they need, we help them with. So it's a really a broad range of veterans that we talk to.
And they call from all over the country?
All over the country.
Huh. And is a good number of the calls, are they coming in not from the vet themselves, but someone who wants to help the vet?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in the cases of veterans that are struggling with PTSD or suicide, a lot of times they're not in a position to be able to identify that they need help or ask for it. And we get calls from spouses and other family members all the time for veterans and their families that are struggling.
That's particularly interesting. We all know a remarkable woman based out of San Diego, Lori Van Tilburg, kind of for 30 years been carrying the torch for caregivers. And she's explained to us right here on this program, and I know she's talked to Shad about it. There are women and men out there who don't realize they're caregivers. Oh, I'm not a caregiver. I'm just helping my husband out since he got back from Iraq. Well, that's wonderful. But you are a caregiver, and the importance of that is that PTSD is contagious. PTSD is contagious to the spouse, to the children.
Absolutely.
And there's no question about the fact that there has to be the right help at the right time, which is why what you do, I think, is so incredibly important. But there are other some good-intentioned phone lines, local, national. What makes the National Veterans Foundation hotline? What's the differentiator? What makes it special?
The big difference between us and a lot of other veteran hotlines is the vet-to-vet model, which Shad pioneered, you know, right after the Vietnam War, and it's been the core of our program model ever since, is that a veteran is most likely to accept help and to get the best result out of it if they're talking to another veteran who has been through what they've been through and who understands the process of transitioning from military to civilian life, who's been through PTSD, all of these issues. They're veterans that answer the phones and help other veterans.
I think it's a tremendous difference. I've seen it firsthand. The comfort level, sometimes not only do you get a vet, but you actually get the same branch. I know one time when I visited the foundation, someone had called in from the 101st Airborne. And when they were able to talk to somebody from the 101st
Absolutely,
Airborne.
Absolutely, yeah. They speak the same language, yeah.
And you put the barrier down. I don't care who you are or where you dialed, there's going to be that question in your head and your heart. Am I really doing the right thing? Should I open up? Shall I talk to this person? They know what the hell they're talking about. And I think that if you're talking to a fellow vet, there's no question it makes it easier and quicker.
Yeah, and it's got more credibility. I mean, I think when a veteran realizes that they're talking to another combat vet, for example, that's been through what they've been through, it cuts through all of that, they're willing to open up a lot more quickly and listen and realize that they're getting good help.
I wonder, on the calls that you get, are they anxious to tell you where they are, what city, what their name is, what they're doing, or do they in the beginning want to remain a voice and anonymous until they're comfortable.
There's a lot of that. I mean, a lot of times the veterans that we deal with are veterans that have hesitancy going to the VA for whatever reason. Maybe they had a bad experience with their exit from the military. They have a distrust of government agencies. So a lot of veterans call and they want to be anonymous. We try and get as much information from them as we can because we like to case manage the situation, follow up with them, and continue to help them. But if a veteran calls in and they're just comfortable talking about their situation without telling us who they are or where they are, that's fine. We'll help them wherever they are.
And, of course, if they're not going to give you their number for you to call back, you can always at least say, let us know how it works out. And get them to call you back.
And we do get a lot of calls back. We have people that call in, weekly to check back in with the counselor.
That's fabulous. Yeah. How do you measure your success? You're dealing in a very sensitive, emotional, gray area. A guy calls with a problem. I've called 27 times. I can't get anybody to help me with my medical claim. And you give them help, and the call's over. If they don't call you back and you don't have their number, how do you know if it worked?
Yeah. You're speaking to me here because, we're looking for that information, from the program side and from the fundraising side. We want to know how that went, and we do everything we can to keep that connection open. But sometimes, like you said, that's the end of the transaction. I mean, they call, they tell us what they want, we give them a resource, or we connect them to someone who can help them or give them information they need. They hang up, and we never know how it went. And that's a challenge.
I'll give you an analogy, if I may. When we put on a matchmaking event, and most of our audience knows that we have a foundation that matches women, minorities, veterans, disabled vets who need a job with those who are hiring. We match a small company owned by a vet or minority or woman who sells widgets, and we match them with a government agency or a corporation that buys widgets, and hopefully it comes together. Regardless of what we do, when it's over, we send a survey out to find out how did it go. And it's like pulling teeth.
Right.
Because they think the survey is something we're going to benefit from and not them. And all we want the survey information for is so maybe we can do it better.
Right.
What worked? What didn't work? What did you like? How good was the program, et cetera? That's exactly what you're doing.
Yeah.
You want to both find out if you were giving the right help to this person, not for ego, but to help them, and secondly, to move on.
Right.
That's tough. Very, very tough. Before we go any further, before we go too deep, we have listeners who are going to want to find out more about the National Veterans Foundation, are going to want to maybe check out the hotline. Certainly, I hope they'll listen to and see Martin Sheen, so dedicated to helping vets and what he's urging the public to do to help. What is the website? What is the phone number for those listening who want to get some help?
So our core program is the Lifeline for Vets, and we encourage any veteran or family member who knows a veteran who needs any kind of help at all to call the Lifeline for Vets at 888-777-4443. Again, it's 888-777-4443. And when you call, you will speak to a veteran counselor. And the website is www.NVVFrank.org. And the website has a ton of resources on it. Anything from finding and getting your DD-214 to dealing with PTSD to a whole section on women veterans and resources for them. There's a wealth of information on our website, and I encourage any veteran who is looking for help to go there as well.
And it is the easiest website to remember. Instead of 12 words and signs and all the garbage that we put up with on some of these websites, you can't get any easier than that. N, like in National, V, like in Veteran, nvflikenfoundation.org, nvf.org, nvf.org. Okay. If you just joined us, Bill Morgan, who wears multiple hats at the National Veterans Foundation, he heads up not only the development team, which keeps the lights on and the good being done, but is involved in every aspect of the operation with Shad Meshad, the CEO and founder. If you have just joined us, you may or may not be aware that while there's a little bit of difference in whose statistics you look at, certainly more than 20 veterans a day are taking their own lives. And that's one of the most horrible and embarrassing statistics in the American lexicon. And these people are helping bring that number down where it belongs, and that's off the table. Is there cooperation between the various veteran groups that are trying to help Bill and the VA itself? And I think you're probably in an awkward position because unquestionably the VA has problems. We know that. If no other reason, there's so many people offering to fix it, so there must be a problem.
Right,
but on the other hand, it's the only game in town right now for certain things. You can't really say, I am so sorry that you're having trouble getting your disability. Why don't you call this other company?
Right.
There's only one.
Right.
How do you deal with that?
Yeah, the VA is it's a large bureaucratic Byzantine organization, and they really prefer to deal with just veterans. So it's difficult as an organization to make inroads and contacts within the VA. We deal a lot with veteran service officers, which are sort of a middleman between the veterans. And
why don't you explain what they do?
So veteran service officers, you know, they go through a training program and they're accredited, and they usually work for a nonprofit. And their job is to help veterans primarily access VA services and to file VA claims, appeal VA claims that have been declined, that sort of thing. They're experts in this, and they're really essential and integral to the whole process.
My wife and I play a game called If I Were King. She plays If I Were Queen. And what we do is solve all the problems of the world, the nation, traffic, environment,
right.
Politics.
Right.
It's very easy. Since we're in the living room and we're getting ready to go to bed, nobody else's life is really affected by it, but it's very gratifying. If I were king, every single veteran that came back that had any problem of any kind that was going to require an evaluation, an assessment, an exam, a treatment, a plan, ultimately money, if I were king, the day they got back, they'd go on a list and would receive a minimum amount until such time as the increased amount was determined, if and when it ever is.
That would be great, yeah.
It'd also be simple. It would immediately eliminate what the VA admits is still its biggest problem, and that's time. The fact that there are so many needing so much help, there's so much processing. Nobody wants money to be given away, taxpayer money to be given away foolishly. But it takes so long. That way, nobody would have to go. You'd lose some calls on things like that and be able to dedicate yourself to other kinds of problems.
Gladly. That would be fantastic.
That would be growth. All right. Well, should I be elected king, I will call you. Yeah. I did get one vote. I did get one vote for president. I have a colleague, friend, who was not happy among many with either candidate,
right.
And she did a write-in for me, took a picture of it, by the way, so we have proof. And if you go to my website or if you look at my biography and you read the various things I've done, you will now see defeated candidate for the presidency of the United States. And I'd like to say on behalf of Hillary and myself, both defeated candidates, that I did not participate in the recount. I found no need for that.
Right, right.
Waste of money. I'm Chuck Ashman. He is Bill Morgan of the National Veterans Foundation. It's NVF.org. NVF.org. Okay. Who is supporting NVF? You get contributions. My guess is, just a guess, an awful lot of them are coming from veterans, families of veterans, widows, widowers of veterans. How much do you know about those who support you, their demographics? Are they younger? Are they older? Are they local? Are they national? What do you know?
It is all over the board, but I think in general we get support from people in an age group anywhere from 30 to, you know, upward from there. It's an older group of people that tend to support the National Veterans Foundation. Although we do get a lot of donations, especially with dedications from young veterans that are making donations in support of their brother soldiers who have died in combat and that sort of thing.
Right.
So you know, it's all over the map, but you know, obviously people who care about veterans and are connected to them, either directly or indirectly.
Now let's use the same criteria and talk about those who call for information or for help. You mentioned that they are the whole range, but are these mostly younger Iraq, Afghan vets looking for something, or is it more the Vietnam group, the older group? Who do you see dominating your inquiries?
We don't have one group that dominates our call demographics. We, you know, transitioning from the military to civilian life can often be a lifetime process. Yeah. And you know, we have Vietnam veterans that call in that are still, that maybe have never asked for help with their PTSD or other issues, or Vietnam veterans that are just now experiencing health problems from Agent Orange and that sort of thing. So we do get a lot of Vietnam veterans calling. We have a lot of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans that are just getting out of the military, and they're just starting their civilian life. And when they get out, a lot of them don't have a plan. You know, what am I going to do now? You know, where am I going to go work? Where am I going to get my benefits? Am I even eligible for benefits?
Right.
That sort of thing.
The next half hour, we're going to bring the world of technology into this issue, and it's something you don't want to miss because it's a remarkable breakthrough enabling a level of efficiency that hasn't been there before. And more efficient, meaning more help. So let me share with you and share with Bill a new program that certainly will be among the things that Bill and his team and Shed and the overall team will be offering up. This program was inspired by an actual incident. A young Marine came out of Pendleton after two tours in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. He had enlisted coming out of high school down in San Diego County and gone on active duty. When he got out, someone knew someone who knew someone, and he ended up flying up to the Silicon Valley for an interview with a major corporation. I don't know if it's appropriate for me to name the major corporation. There's nothing negative in what they did. I just don't think it's necessary. Let's just say their corporate name is the same as a piece of fruit. Anyway, the Marine went in for the interview, and a very nice older woman in her 60s who probably had a lifetime of HR experience interviewing people, placing them, well-intentioned, courteous, asked him a really poignant and very appropriate question, because she knew that he had enlisted actually the day he graduated. He and a bunch of buddies went on, you know, went down to the Marine Corps, and that was it. He's not alone in that. And she said, "What have you learned since you graduated high school? What skills?" Good question. And he wasn't trying to be a smartass. He said, "I learned to march and kill." she didn't have any openings for those particular skill sets.
Right.
And we learned about the story, and several of us who were concerned with that kind of thing actually met with the young man and convinced him that what he said was true. But there was another true statement that he could have made. He could have said, "Ma'am, I learned to take orders, occasionally give them. I learned to be part of a team. I learned what it means to be under pressure when you have to get a job done on time and on budget. And I learned to always be physically and mentally able to deal with any changes that came along." Equally true statement, and he'd be working there today.
Sure.
Maybe in the dining room, I don't know, but he'd be working there today. And that inspired us, and we are now engaged in a new program with support from people like HP and people like Union Bank, and we're going to bases. And as part of the Boots to Business re-entry into civilian life training that they get, in addition to the formal stuff, here's who you can call for housing and here's the doctor's name, we're teaching him the practical stuff, like you don't have to say, "I learned how to march and kill."
Right.
We know that. Try the other. And here's the interesting part, Bill. You'll like this. We're doing that on the bases. And HP is going to bring together, starting in the Silicon Valley, will roll out nationally, the HR directors. So they learn the lingo and culture of the military.
Wow.
So if someone walks in and said, "Yes, I was a CB." I'm sorry? "I was a CB." They'll know what the CBs do. And someone will say, "Ma'am, if I can build a bridge while under fire in Iraq, I'm not going to have any problems in Omaha working on a bridge."
Exactly, exactly.
When we come back, when we return, we will go to the world of technology and look to your left and look to your right. You may not see it. I don't care what business you're in or what you do to make a living. You got a partner. Maybe silent. It's called technology. After this. I'm Chuck Ashman, my guest in studio, Bill Morgan, representing the National Veterans Foundation. Man and machine. The surgeon relies upon a computer and a robotic arm to be more exact in making the incision, man and machine. The government's top intelligence experts rely upon software to capture and even explain what our enemies are saying. We human beings have somewhat reluctantly accepted the reality that each of us is partnered with technology in all aspects of our lives, in our homes, in the office, with regard to health, or education, or entertainment, or travel. There is a device, or a software, or an app, or a combination to make it easier and cheaper, and most often far more efficient than just relying upon our human abilities. One of the architects of the marriage between man and machine, people and technology, between souls and software is Steve Cracknell. He's the CEO of Zenti, Z-E-N-T-I, Inc. And he's got a background in marketing, and that's important. He's got those people skills, which makes him a rare hybrid. Here we have a thinking human being who understands geek, which is so much better than having a geek who thinks they understand human. He joins us from the Gigabyte Garden, where Dr. Google roams, and Bill Gates, not Adam, eats the apple. Oh, I like that. He joins us from the Gigabyte Garden, where Dr. Google roams, and Bill Gates, not Adam, ate the apple. From the Silicon Valley, we'll learn about Zenti and the remarkable connection between their work and the opportunity created for what Bill's working on at the National Veterans Foundation. All right, Steve, how did a South African-born, British-trained finance guy with a flair for marketing end up with cutting-edge software?
Well, good morning, Chuck, and thank you for that amazing introduction. Great question. I'd say that by chance, really. You know, when I was still in the financial industry, I was a passive investor in small machine learning companies, and I made a very small investment in Zenti, which at the time was, you know, based in Palo Alto. And as I saw the technology evolve and the development of it involved, I got more involved from a product development perspective. And I guess as with anything that becomes fascinating and interesting, I got lured into the potential of it. And over a period of a year and a half, got so involved that I ended up relocating to Silicon Valley to help grow the company.
What is the company? What is Zenti? What's its core mission, and what is it doing? And what was the company doing before this particular program that you've made available to the National Veterans Foundation?
So I guess the description of Zenti is that it's a machine learning algorithm that can process unstructured text data, but significantly it can do it in such a way that it can identify human emotion and intent, and that it can understand communication in context. So I mean that's probably quite a mouthful, but I guess in the sense that as a human being, if somebody expresses some kind of form of emotion verbally, or if they write it in a text message, or if they send it in an email, or if they send it in a social media channel, we can interpret it as humans to get a sense of what they're saying. What we've been able to do using machine learning is program a system to understand what the intent of an individual is. I think... Well, what we think we've done that is significant is that we've developed the software such that it's accessible to subject matter experts like Bill. And machine learning and algorithms typically scare off subject matter experts because it's like, hey, this is for engineers and this is for data scientists. And we've really focused on making machine learning simple and accessible. And I think that's what our mission is. You know, make machine learning accessible to people that are specialists in their field without requiring an engineering degree.
Over the years, Steve, I've been a coach. I've coached executives, CEOs, one president of the United States, and in the course of presentation coaching, we've always tried to impart the message that how well they speak is very important and could be as high as the fifth most important thing in the presentation, but never getting any higher than number five. And we discuss with them everything from their appearance to their gestures to their eye contact to their movements to their props, what have you. And collectively, an audience responds to that. With that as a base and trying to bring that technology down to, you know, basics. Are you only able to evaluate a particular word because of its definition, or are you able to go wider? How the word is said, is that measured? The context, other things other than the definition of the word?
So that's a fascinating question, and the reason I say that is that's always been part of the challenge, is that humans have an ability to interpret those subtleties or the context of communication. And if we think of it in terms of verbal expression standing in front of somebody, you can interpret a lot of the intent by things that aren't said. In the written sense of the word, we have to apply a similar logic, which is, as a human, if I read a line of text, how do I interpret this? And part of the process that we've applied is that we use a statistical process and we tokenize the underlying words. And what that allows us to do is that I can read a line of text and say, is this about anger? Is this about depression? Is this about finance? Is this about humor? And as a human, I can make a judgment and say, yes, this is about somebody, you know, saying something funny. We tokenize those underlying combinations of words and phrases into, you think of them as a mathematical token. And then we work out the statistical probability that that is about humor or that is about anger. And then through a process of training, where as a human I make a simple decision, yes, that's about humor, no, that's not about humor, we build up a statistical reference to understand what that piece of text is saying. So I guess to answer your question,
wow,
is we don't just take a single word, we take all of the words and all of the combining words that sit around them, and then we simply create a mathematical process that says this is statistically likely about someone being humorous. But what is key is that as a human, I made that judgment call up front. I know what that looks like. I made the call. The machine is simply saying, okay, I understand what you've said. I'm now going to look for similar patterns going forward. So a single word. So for example, if somebody says, I'm having a great day, ... not, everything about that is positive except the final portion of it, which we know is somewhat sarcastic. But we've figured out a way to teach our system to...
You have a sarcasm meter? You actually, you can tell... do you have a smart-ass meter? In other words, I remember someone giving us an example. I was a newscaster for a lot of years, and I could have said 50 pregnant women were protesting outside the church the latest message from the Vatican. 50 women are outside the church. They're protesting the word from the Vatican. I can change it without changing a word. The mood, you actually can dig into the intended use of the word, not just the meaning of the word. I think that's amazing. Amazing.
And it's, what I would tend to agree with you. But secondly, I think what's amazing is that, again, the process is around, you know, making a decision, as in, I can read something, I know that that's sarcastic, yes, I'm going to tell the machine that that's sarcastic. So the machine now captures that human understanding, and then it looks for similar patterns and signals. And I think what's important to note is that because it's mathematical and statistical, it's never going to be 100% accurate. But when you apply it to large volumes of data, and certainly in the context of social media, there's so much flowing information, humans just physically can't read that much content. There's just too much to go through. So by programming a machine to say, hey, this is an indication of sarcasm, or this is an indication of depression, or this is an indication of anger, and scoring it, and then giving it to somebody like Bill or something like a specialist psychologist, or it then helps them make a much better decision more quickly. So that's kind of the gap that we think we're filling.
I imagine, no one's told me this, but it certainly would seem logical, that what the government is doing in the war on terrorism and trying to search social media for hints of problems to come, it's very much the same approach, finding the words, finding the context, seeing how they match up. Is there a viable comparison there, do you think?
I mean, I would say so. I would say that in the context of, you know, the intelligence agencies, I mean, billions and billions of dollars will be spent or are being spent, and they will have teams of engineers, teams of data scientists working 24/7. So as much as I'd like to say, yes, we're exactly the same as those guys, I mean, we're not. I mean, we're obviously a lot smaller, and the capability of our system is much more focused around how do we give a subject matter expert access to a machine or access to the technology without them having to be an engineer or a data scientist. And that's kind of where I would think accessible machine learning is an important step change to allow more and more people to capture the power of machine learning and to capture the power of big data, but through a much simpler interface. So, you know, I mean, there's companies like Palantir, there's companies like IBM Watson that have developed very sophisticated machine learning algorithms and technologies. And, you know, they're by far, I would say, the leaders in this space. But for the average business or the average institutional foundation like the NBF, completely inaccessible because it's too expensive. And, you know, if it comes with a team of consultants that have to help you get it set up, they can't afford to do that. Big companies can do it, but the little guy or mid-sized businesses aren't in a position to afford to do that. So we think we're starting on the other end of the spectrum, which is to say, let's make this accessible from the bottom up as opposed to, you know, charging off to the big corporates and the big institutions.
Bill, your son is the mathematician in the family. I know that. Are you able to handle this challenge? Have you been able, without any engineering background, to be able to use the tool?
Yeah, it's really easy to use. I mean, you know, the way that we started the process was to put in keywords that we thought were relevant to veterans that were
Give us an example.
So, you know, we put in multiple tours, sleep problems, or I'm having trouble sleeping, keywords like that. And we look at the results, and the way that the system works is it brings back a series of social media posts. And then I say, yes, this is relevant, this is what we're looking for, or no, this one isn't. And as I go through that process...
So you add your knowledge...
I'm training.
...and your experience
exactly.
to help... In other words, if I get this right, you're getting an educated student with a bachelor's degree, which is his technology, and you're helping it go for the master's by giving it some other... impressions and knowledge and everything else. It's building. It's got to be a building block.
Yeah, the expertise on our end is essential to the process, and we're constantly dialoguing with this platform to teach it, you know, the messages that we're looking for from veterans that are expressing problems with PTSD and other issues. And, it's a really easy-to-use piece of software, actually.
Steve, tell us about the results to date from a standpoint of just efficiency in achieving the technical goal. Are you finding that what your algorithms and your technology think they found is what they found?
So one thing that we found very interesting is that the power of the technology is really only as good as the input that it receives from people like Bill and, you know, people like Dr. Joe Franklin, who we worked with at Florida State University, teaching it to understand different types of intent. And I think, you know, initially the system had a capability which says, okay, we can tokenize text and we can classify it and we can use funky maths and algorithms to make sense of something. But what we found to kind of really push us forward is that when we get that human insight to make those subtle decision points, that's where we've seen a shift change in the result set that we get. And the fact is that, you know, in the context of depression or suicidal ideation or hopelessness, which are obviously very serious topics, you know, if somebody in social media says, I'm going to just throw myself off a bridge, does that mean that they actually have an intent to do that? And then if we look at their historical communication, and then are there other signals that would indicate that they really are intent on doing something? What we've found is that getting specialists like Dr. Joe Franklin, who's a special psychologist, and then Bill Morgan and their team, they've been able to improve the accuracy of what the real intent is. And I think that's where why we've so enjoyed this partnership is that we've also now discovered aspects of what's possible through their insights. And again, they're not the mathematicians or the data scientists. They're the experts in their field. So I think, you know, where we were maybe, you know, had an accuracy of about 80%, that would now have gone to 90 or 95% because of the human insight from these experts.
Well, listen, first of all, thank you for the service to those who have served that you're performing by applying this breakthrough technology in that area. You could just as easily be at Macy's, and they could be using the algorithms to check what it is that the customer is most likely going to buy, and I guarantee you that when that customer walked in, there'd be a pop-up store with those products by the entrance where he parked his car. So I can think of a thousand things on the commercial side, and you've chosen to do it where, you know, we can save lives and help the quality of lives. Do you think it will go to the next step? Do you think that with artificial intelligence, once you have recognized something, that the technology will help draft the response, the content of the message going back? Or is it only Sherlock Holmes, and it makes its detective work known and turns it over and then moves on to the next case? Or does it stick around for the trial?
Yeah, I like your question. I think, I think 2 points there. I think in the first instance, in the context of suicide prevention and in the context of helping people that need help, I think the value of what the NVF does and their vet-to-vet outreach program is not something that we would ever want to change and make automated. I think the ability for somebody like Bill, who has served and that's experienced coming back from a tour and then coming back into day-to-day society, that value is what makes NVF different and special. So I think the ability to identify and then put somebody in touch with someone that can help them, I think our goal is to keep that the same. I think in the context of, you know, other applications whereby a machine could say statistically, based on all these other questions we've had, these are the answers. There are examples. I mean, for example, you know, AI medics or automated doctor responses to say, I have a sore knee, you know, click all the various symptoms. I think there's areas where artificial intelligence and machine learning can speed up the process of identifying or eliminating symptoms that I would say are more general or don't have the same consequence as somebody that's expressing suicidal intent. So I think there's a use case where machine learning and AI can be used to make more efficient decisions or help people get a more efficient answer. But I think in the context of helping vets and the kind of service that the NVF and other foundations similar provide, I think that human touch is always going to be essential. And again, that's in my opinion, at least.
I have to call friends in South Africa and thank them for you, because I really think you've brought something to the table that is absolutely remarkable. I have a toy that I use. Please don't ask me what it's called or how it does it. But if I input that I'm driving to San Francisco, which I do every other month or so and enjoy, it will suddenly spit out, did you want to stop off at Harry's house when you pass Fresno? And it'll remind me of the restaurant that I've eaten at in the past in a particular town, what motel I stayed at. And then, of course, the basics like the weather and the road conditions and everything else. I look forward to having a robot at home that will not just do what I tell him, but will probably tell me what to do. Steve, you're doing fascinating work, and having chosen not to just go the route of how quick and how much can we make, and that's all that matters, you've chosen to really, really help an extremely important cause. I mean, if one vet who was going to take his or her life is discovered as a direct result, then it was worth it, and I suspect there'll be a lot of zeros after the one. He's Steve Cracknell from Zenti Inc. Bill Morgan is with us from the National Veterans Foundation. I'm Chuck Ashman. We call it Diversity American Style.
You're listening to Diversity American Style with Chuck Ashman, only on LA Talk Radio.